Welcome to Lead to Succeed. This is the podcast to hear from the leaders of today in various fields, from entrepreneurs to corporate directors.
We hear their stories, lessons learned and challenges faced, as well as insights and advice to become a successful and an inspiring leader.
The podcast is presented by us,
Callum
and Rebecca Jenkins, as we both believe that we all have the potential to be outstanding leaders if that's what we choose. So hello AC, we are really delighted and a big thank you for having you on our Lead to Succeed podcast today. So I'm Rebecca Jenkins and this is Callum, and we're really looking forward to hearing about you, hearing about your background and your achievements today, because you are the CEO and founder of Project Imagine. And when we've had a read about what you've achieved, it's quite amazing. You've raised 15 million in your first 2 years, is that correct? Yeah. And you're the 25th in scale of startups in the UK. Yep. And you've now got a team of 50.
Yep, it's pretty spot on.
So maybe you would just like to kick off with giving us a bit of background to you, something interesting and that you could share with our listeners, just to give them a little bit more information about you.
Cool. Well, first of all, thank you for having me here. I love what you're doing and the topics you're raising, so pretty close to heart, so pleasure to be here. A quick professional background. I'm a banker by trade. I've only ever been in HSBC, actually, only in one bank, but I've worked for them across London, New York, and Hong Kong, and in many divisions within the banks. I started off in investment banking, then did some trading, and then moved to a principal M&A role, which meant buying and selling banks for the HSBC group rather than advising external clients. Then went into the private bank, which needed some cleanup at the time. And by the time I was 29, I was pretty well paid. I was a director, and I'd only ever slashed businesses or cut costs and not built anything. So that's how the move to digital happened, because I'd always been a bit sort of geeky with tech and gadgets, and I love gadgets and I buy a lot of them. So I thought maybe the sort of juxtaposition of finance and tech would be good for me. And that was 2013, 2014, when fintech was still a new world, And because I was in private banking, doing digital for private banking is a bit of an oxymoron, because it's still a very white glove, high touch industry. So I had to move down a segment to wealth, which is still richer than the average person on the road, but goes all the way into a sort of more retail mindset where people actually wanted to transact on digital. And that was a sort of sea change happening around that time in the world. So before I left HSBC, I was leading their wealth digital transactions team, which meant I worked on things like robo-advice, structured products, FX, P2P, everything apart from the plain vanilla banking products. But interestingly, a couple of statistics from that role sort of stuck on with me, which might have gone into the making of Project Imagine. On the higher end, it's very interesting that people who have money do not invest. Most people think that investments are not for them. So 1 in 10 of the sort of top segments of banks worldwide actually buy investment products. And it's down to a bit of psychology on the consumer side, because they have loss aversion and they don't like losing money, and investments obviously put your capital at risk. It's also down to a bit on the bank side, where because they run their books off credit, like loans and mortgages and credit cards, and when you invest, your money goes out of the bank's balance sheet into whatever stock or ETF or investment that you put it into. The banks don't like investing as well, because that means they can't lend, and that puts their business model at risk. So it's curious on the high end. It's also curious on the low end, because people check their balance twice per day on average. That is crazy, right? Because most of us, most of the people we know, maybe check it twice a week, twice a fortnight, maybe even twice a month. So some segments are checking 5-7 times a day to make that average so high, and obviously not getting paid that often. So you're looking for some reassurance on spending for buying the next gadget or pint or whatever, like on Friday night. And I just couldn't get enough traction on these deeply psychological, like sort of insights into how the retail consumer thinks. And if we didn't attack both of these, we couldn't sort of make societal change when it comes to how people think about money. Because if you got lucky and started saving, your savings, the rate at which they grow would be lower than inflation. So you'd actually be losing money over a long period of time. So your retirement's not going to look very good. So all of that led me to sort of start thinking about what not just fintech, but the finance world would miss and where we could sort of still have a gap. Because by the time we started, Monzo and Starling and Revolut and all these guys are still already pretty big. So we had to create a niche that could talk about financial products and these needs rather than just digital awareness. That's how Project Imagine came into being. Maybe none of that is super interesting, so I'll give you a quick personal interesting bit. So I go by AC, but my name is Aritra, and it's a Sanskrit word because I come from India, and it means someone with no enemies. There you go.
What do you with?
Someone with no enemies.
Oh, okay.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Yes.
No, I thought your professional background was quite interesting. I thought that was, I think what I find fascinating is how you've gone from quite a large, I would say, corporate position in a very, you know, a very large company to doing something which is still in the same industry, but kind of like the other end of the spectrum in terms of being quite disruptive, startup, smaller team, that sort of thing. So I find that really interesting. You're still in the same industry, but fundamentally doing something really quite different. I thought your professional background was very interesting, yeah.
And the fact that you were a director at a young age, what for you, AC, was the transition from being a manager to a leader? Do you feel there was a point in time when you recognised that you'd stepped into a leadership position?
I think I was always difficult to manage to start with. And probably my very early insights on leadership and gaps in leadership frameworks or how leaders behave come from probably recollecting or recording my managers, various managers in various places' reactions to my ideas and thoughts. And there's always a bit of sort of risk aversion. And when you're young and energetic and have lots of ideas, you want the freedom to pursue some of those ideas to see, not in a sort of, you know, bull in a china shop way, but just to see what could stick, because otherwise you're kind of doing the same, right? And there was this very big worry in my mind of either not knowing what we're doing and therefore sort of efficiently producing, I don't know what the right politically correct word would be, but I would say efficiently producing shit. That's quite a big management problem, right? Because managers usually solve for efficiency, not effectiveness. And that's a big difference that I sort of charted right very early on in my career. And the second thing would be, like, as I started managing people, I realized that actually there may be a bit of a generational phenomenon happening because of the iPhone and sort of technology getting so democratized in 2007. And the years that followed, and anyone could start creating apps and, you know, experiences that billions of people worldwide could use. You suddenly had some very established ways to get into big jobs like B schools or degrees and stuff sort of became a little bit less relevant, like amazing school names, you know, slightly less relevant today than they were 15 years ago. They're still relevant, but slightly less so than 15 years ago. And what that meant is that people who came and worked in these roles, and like people younger than me, seemed to identify with my sense of righteousness or what we wanted to do rather than what the institution wanted. And then in one of my conversations with one of these teams, I came across the sort of description that still rings true, that at some point, you know, our parents, for example, wanted to work for someone for their life. And that changed to I wanted to work for myself at some place. And that's a fundamental shift in how employees want to be treated today. I don't know what the age at which this sort of change happens, but like it's definite today that if you hire young people, they're not looking to be with you for the next 40 years and retire with a gold watch, which means that you have to retain them, otherwise they're going to the next place. And that's got its own issues, but as an employer, if I put a lot of effort into hiring someone, I really want to retain them. And that means I need to think about the world like they do. And if they want to be thinking that they're working for themselves, then this social contract that goes beyond the employment contract has to ring true. And I don't think managers get social contracts. Managers get employment contracts. and leaders think about social contracts. What is it that I owe you over and above a paycheck? What is it that I expect from you over and above the hours? And that's what sort of creates great teams.
I think that's a really good point. That's definitely something I can relate to myself, as we talked about a little bit before we started the podcast, that for me, when I was at university, I was always quite interested in working for myself, the more entrepreneurial side of things than the corporate sort of job that you were just talking about. And the next question I was going to ask you, AC, was, do you think there was a time or point in your career when you transitioned from being more of a manager to being more of a leader? Now, based on what you just said, I imagine that might perhaps be from leaving HSBC to now running your own startup and being an employer. Do you think that would be the point when you transitioned from a manager to a leader, or was it before that?
I don't know, actually. You know, on one level, I don't think so, because I don't think I was very different as a leader, even within a large bank. Sure. As in, the people that worked with me in my team would probably have very similar experiences today as they did in the bank. So the bank and its structure was, it was different in how and what issues and how those issues had to be dealt with for me, and looking upwards, but not looking to people that were working with me. On the other hand, I think no one ever thinks that they're a manager. I think everyone thinks they're a leader. So you can only kind of retrospectively say that at that point, I think I was still sort of managing.
Sure.
And because I cared about, because of what I said before about, you know, what I cared about myself, I never quite cared about getting a list done. So I never managed for getting a list done. So to that extent of the definition of like wanting bigger things for everyone and trying to align incentives with the company that we were working for, I think I was a bit less of a traditional manager from day one. Sure. I certainly wasn't managing for efficiency.
Okay. So do you think, kind of along that that sort of train of thought, you were more interested in the development of others rather than just yourself? Is that sort of what you were talking about, would you say?
Yeah. But the way you say it, it makes it sound altruistic. I have a slightly more kind of selfish tone on it, in the sense that I don't think it's possible to create good stuff without me worrying about your development.
Yeah, sure.
You just wouldn't give me your 120%, right? Like that, and that's what I call the social contract. Like if it was limited down to hours and wages, it's completely different. Like exactly the same people, same company will produce different results without that extra social contract. So I have to worry about your development.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really interesting point. I think it's, you know, if you feel like you're being cared for and more than just the money you're going to receive, you're going to go that extra mile, aren't you? You're going to put that extra effort in.
To keep it sort of good for me, right? Like no one wants to manage like a kind of flat person, you know, over years, because it's not curious. It's not sort of, it's a relationship at the end of the day, and you want relationships to evolve with time. And if you're flat and not growing, it's just boring after a while. So it's in everyone's interest that everyone keeps growing.
Yeah, no, most definitely. I think that's a really fresh perspective on that, isn't it? I think it ties into what other people have also said, but it's an interesting sort of spin on that. Kind of tying in with that, AC, would you say there's ever been, I'm sure there has been, but what would you say was a really significant challenge you faced as a leader, either at HSBC or at Project Imagine? Would you say there was something that really sort of stood out for you as a really difficult thing to overcome?
I mean, obviously, like, you know, in the operational sense, there's challenges every day that you have to overcome, whether in a kind of senior role in a large corporate or a bank, or, you know, certainly for founding a regulated startup, sure. Overcome challenges all the time. But I'll try and answer your question in a sort of people way, and maybe try and connect it to the previous sort of definition difference between management and leadership. I think I kind of view managers as people who kind of lead from the front. And I don't think leaders should, and I don't mean like sort of not be the face of the company. It's impossible for me to be not be the face of Project Imagine. That's an occupational hazard that goes with the role, right? But in the feeling of leadership, it should feel like I'm kind of pushing people along rather than pulling them along. And again, these are not my words. These are sort of words shared by people that I've managed before. And we were kind of discussing this one person in the team that they did not like working with. And I thought I was harsher than this person. And so I asked, like, why do you like working with me then? Like, I'm way harsher than this guy. They said, like, he makes us feel like he's pulling us. And then if he drops us, we'll be left behind. Whereas you make us feel like if you drop it, then you'll still get picked up and taken along. And there's nothing that I do consciously for that feeling, and it's impossible to train for. But I think it goes back to that social contract again. If you start worrying about these things that you don't have to worry about, then the feeling that you will give off is you care about people and you care about stuff and you won't just drop them at the first thing. A way that we manifest that in Project Imagine is you have performance immunity after you pass probation. So that means that your performance, once we've made sure that you're a good guy, so we've got a values axis, which is the y-axis, and performance stuff is on the x-axis. And in values, we measure ownership, we measure team first, so you make decisions for yourself and your progression of the team, and moral compass, which is kind of an absolute good and bad thing. And performance is everything else, like ambition and impact and hard work. And you can never get fired for failing on performance as long as your values are good. And that creates a sense of risk-taking. Like, people want to take more risks and try and evolve and try and do more things. And it's really hard to implement. For me, that's a challenge, because when you do that, then you can set the expectation that everyone will be taken care of. But that is not the case, is it? So leadership does not mean, it means generosity. It does not mean kind of screwing the shareholders. Mm-hmm. I still have fiduciary duties to the shareholders, and I have to run a business that is always short of cash, and it should stay short of cash. That's what the stage we're in is. No matter how much you invest in us, we'll do more things. So we'll always have cash issues, unlike a big bank. So that means I have to take everyone along while still dropping the people who are not responding to nudges. And that's a significant challenge as a leader, because it can make you look inauthentic if you don't do it the right way. But the challenge is real. I have to worry about shareholders, and I have to get people along.
Yeah.
Are you very open in that? I would imagine that you are, AC, that you kind of share that with your team, as you've explained to us. I would imagine that you talk that through with them.
Yes, this is a kind of communicated, transparent framework that we actually do our assessments with. We sometimes even recruit on it. Like, if all of us like someone, then we don't use frameworks. But if we get split down the middle on a person or a candidate, then we try and use the same framework to see what is it that's causing the grayness. Is it a y-axis thing or an x-axis thing? So, we don't do values as like posters as many companies do. So when you walk into our offices, and whenever we have a physical office again, but there's no posters with our values in it. It's just something that we promote on, fire on, retain on, hire on. And this is the framework that sort of decides all of that. So it's pretty well known. We also have transparent salaries. So you can, on the company intranet, you can go and check everyone's salaries. So not just against their bands, but like their names, all the way up to me. So that means while I worry about the Y and the X axis, I also have to worry about someone stopping me in the corridor and going like, why am I not paid as much as this other guy? Because I'm actually producing more. And between those two, it creates quite an interesting dynamic with the way we sort of deal with people. But you can tell that transparency is pretty important for me.
Very much so. And have you had any difficult conversations as a result of that level of transparency?
Not on the salary bit, because, I always say, like, we owe transparency, as in we need to be able to answer why we made a decision, and certainly what decisions were made, and there's no cloak and daggers about decisions. For example, like, everything was on Slack, so every team can see each other's Slack channels. There's no emails, virtually no emails at all internally. So we only use emails for external correspondence. And you can go on Slack and check some other team channel and see what they're up to. And it helps us sort of prevent some mishaps sometimes, because maybe some bad judgment was being applied and someone else catches it. So I don't think that I owe changing my decisions because of transparency. That's what I would call democracy. Mm. Transparency is not democracy. So obviously when, especially because the concepts are so new and there are not many companies sort of doing it this way, especially with young people who haven't had a lot of work experience, they may not even know why transparency is so special.
Yeah.
They might sort of be a slightly bit more entitled about the democracy bits. And then those are the difficult elements where you have to say that, look, I owe you an explanation. I'm not going to change my decision. I would make this 100 times again. And I would explain it 100 times again and hope you follow. But your reactions are not going to change my decision. And drawing that sort of, it's almost a parental line, right? Like, you kind of want to sort of show it, but then you know that where to draw the line, like, yeah, stop arguing now, it's bedtime.
Yes. Yeah, I understand that point completely. How important, AC, has personal, well, not personal development, but training and development been to you in your career and with your team? How high a priority do you put that in the business?
Could you repeat that question again? So I caught the last bit, not the middle bit.
Sorry, AC. How important has training and development been to you in your career? And how important is it to you in developing your team?
Yeah, super important. But the catch is, what is training and development? Sending someone for a sort of course that looks good on paper but is sort of badly executed is not training and development in my book. And there's a lot of that in corporates, right? Like, you get training budgets and then you sort of go on these, you can't even choose your best course. You have to go from a roster that's been chosen by someone in procurement. And, you know, these things change all the time and procurement doesn't change all the time. So I don't consider that training and development. I think on the job training, like giving people sort of slightly stretched targets of what they think they can deliver so that they can have a safe space to sort of learn and keep getting better. And where required, then technical training, but of a high caliber, is really important. So we have sent people on courses in Oxford. I've gone to Stanford myself. You know, so these are high value training programs that have to be earned. So we're not saying that everyone who joins Project Imagine would like get X amount of money for like doing courses. Mm-hmm. But when you do well and we figure out that it's not on the job training, but actually a technical topic that needs input, we're happy to sponsor that. So it's super important. During the COVID time, I've actually started something called PIMS that we've now lovingly coined as PIMS. So it's a PI Masters of Modern Management Studies. What I've done is basically, because we have such a diverse workforce, every Wednesday, so it's going to be, we're recording on a Wednesday, so it's going to be right after this podcast. 6:30 to 8:30, there's around 20 of us who get together and we play on a business simulator and talk about economics and accounting and marketing and all the stuff that you need to run a modern business today. And it's amazing to see people who work in the studio and are artists and animators and these guys sort of talking fluently about accounting things now. So that's sort of our approach to training. It's way more thought through than just budgeting.
It's a nice way to look at it. And I'm personally a big believer in your best training is when you're actually learning something in the environment, or it could be outside the environment, but it's not just being taught something, it's actually putting it into practice as you go through it and you learn as you implement.
And there is a difference between the academic world and the practical world, right? Like, for example, the topics that I just talked about, even if you go to the best B school, you still learn them separately. You learn economics and then you actually learn the microeconomics and then, you know, accounting and then some other term like the investment topics will come up. So you don't actually connect them all together. When you apply them in business, you have to think about your demand and supply curves at the same time as thinking about your margins and your NPVs, and like everything needs to sort of go into one synopsis. And there's no school offering that. So who thinks like that? The business people do. Do they teach? Yeah. No. So if we can actually convince some of our senior most people to try and put academic frameworks around their own inherent decision-making, I think that's actually more useful for everyone in a business sense than some schools are.
I completely agree with that. Again, because, you know, too often we'll find people that are business coaches, but they've never actually run a business. It's the same analogy, really, isn't it? Once you've been through it, you know it. You've experienced the hard times, and you can talk that through and help to educate others on it.
You know, Bill Gates has a really interesting talk on this. His posit is that basically the way we recruit for, pay, and incentivize teachers in universities, professors, is completely not right for what we want our universities to do. Mm. We don't want our universities to give rise to research scholars, right? There's some courses that do, but most university courses are for the business world of a practical application. And he has said that basically that if Microsoft got involved and like sponsored a university, as in it was completely free for the students and it would be paid for by the corporates that recruited from there, that the teaching experience there would be completely different. So you should look that up. There's a really, really good academic stream now developing around this thesis.
Okay, thank you. I'm making a note to have a look at that. AC, what would be the three key pieces of advice you would give an aspiring manager or leader? Sort of practical advice that they could listen to this podcast and go, yes, I could implement that with my team tomorrow, or I could do that differently. So based on your experience, what would you say?
I always find these hard, the three and the two is the ones, but I'll give it a go.
It's easier, isn't it?
Yeah. The number one thing for me, without doubt, is that it's much easier to manage employees, but it's much better to lead people. So people are not employees, right? They have life outside work and they have their own issues and like joys and tribulations, like whatever they're going through. And the same person, this is a really, really important facet, but the same, it's not even the person in a role that matters, because you could think that you're doing a good job if I see like you've got a skill there and you're being underutilized in this job, can we move you to this other job? And you might think that's the end of leadership, but that same person, when they split up in a relationship, they're in a completely different space. And if you only consider them as an employee, then how are you ever going to know about it, let alone do anything about that phase for them? And I think if you want retention in this fast-moving world, we have to care about our employees as people and know a lot about their lives so that they feel safe to share it. And with a view to not punish them and, you know, get sort of advantages out of that, but just be there for them when they need it. So that's number one, definitely, like lead people, not manage employees. And second and third, maybe second is about authenticity. I don't think you can do any of this without genuinely caring. So if you find it hard to genuinely care about people, I don't think that's to be judged. I think there are some people who care about others and some people who care about a skill or an output. And I think it should be okay to explore individual contribution careers. Like you could become a really, really good designer without ever having to manage someone. And that's completely fine. I think the burden of management should go away. And number three maybe is to just pick a field that you enjoy getting out of bed for. Because if you're not happy yourself, if you're miserable coming to work, there's just no way that you can inspire another human being. Yeah, I'd be happy with those three. See, I've already forgotten to do so, let alone be happy.
Lead, not manage, be authentic and care.
Yeah, and if not, then follow individual roles and not leadership roles.
Yeah.
And pick something that you actually genuinely love doing. Otherwise, it's impossible.
I think those are three really key topics. I can definitely relate to that. And yeah, I just think they're three very key areas. And I can definitely relate to, you know, the third point about doing something that you really enjoy and being passionate about. Because if you're not actually truly passionate about it yourself, then there's no way you're going to be able to inspire other people. But what that kind of leads me into my next question, AC, is, you know, would you have any advice for people that would look at what you've done in your career and would aspire to maybe do something similar? So perhaps they're in a large corporate organization in a corporate kind of role, which you were in, and they aspire to perhaps either work for themselves or maybe set up a startup one day or something like that, that's, you know, slightly more disruptive, on a slightly smaller scale, but more innovative and that kind of thing. Would you have any advice for people that want to transition from that corporate lifestyle to something more like a startup? And in terms of perhaps what they might expect to be able to demonstrate when they're leading.
Yeah, it's sort of leading backwards from that I think the advice is going to sound a bit cliche, but it's really that make sure you want to do it.
Yeah,
because,
sure.
You know, the grass is always greener, and there's things about corporate life that is safe and reliable and like, and not just in a sort of boring way, but you know what works, and you can, it's almost like someone gives you the list. And the biggest challenge when you sort of come out of it, I think, is that you have to create your own list. There's literally no ad, like for all the joys of not having a boss, I miss someone giving me a list. So my, the thing that keeps me awake at night is like, what am I not thinking about? Which is lesser of a challenge in a slightly more structured corporate role, because someone's setting your objectives unless you go to the top again. And also you realize very quickly that even if some talent was working with you under a brand, then you don't know whether they were working for the brand or working for you. And when you don't have that brand and you're setting up something from scratch, then you have to hire on literally nothing apart from your own persona and experience and background, and whether people, like talented, skillful people, choose to leave their sometimes corporate jobs and come to you would depend on whether they can trust that. And because there's literally nothing else, there's no name on the door. And I had some pretty interesting moments in that. You know, sometimes you would think that leaving a job is the biggest and riskiest decision before starting something. But when the penny really dropped for me was not when I left my job or started something, it was when someone else turned in the notice. The first three people who turned in the notice did that on the same day, because like, we kind of planned, you know, on this is the day on where we're going to start. And then three of them turned in the notice on the same day and sent me a text saying, okay, that's done. So we're on for February or whatever. And that's when the penny dropped, like, shit, like now their salaries depend on me. So this isn't about like my risk appetite anymore.
Yeah.
I've put other people in play. And that was quite a moment that I wouldn't forget.
We're going to sort of start wrapping up now, AC. What is so far the moment that you're really most proud of in your current role and what you're achieving? Because you have achieved so much in such a short space of time, that's really impressive. What are you most pleased about?
I think, again, like might sound like a cliche, but I genuinely mean it. It's just the team. When you walk into our offices, there is a palpable, you know, non-verbal feeling that everyone who walks in comments on. And sometimes I've done events and they go like, I mean, why do you guys smile so much? And like, are they like paying you to smile? Are they like forcing you to smile? And it's just a really good group of skilled, talented, ambitious, hardworking people. And beyond a certain scale, this becomes hard to break. As hard as it is to hire consistently good people, when you get 50 of them together, then they kind of do the hiring for you, because, you know, A players don't want to work with B players. So now I don't have to be the guardian of quality anymore. There's enough good people in the company that will hire the similar minded people. And I think that's probably been our sort of biggest achievement outside the operational bits. I mean, operationally, we're still a startup, right? So we could not be here next year. But what won't go away is that feeling of team and stuff that we've created from scratch.
I think when you've got that sense of a team really supporting, working, committed, you say you might not, you know, there's a risk attached to it, but it feels like less of a risk when you've got that real support. So come what may, whatever challenges that you face, together you'll get through it. And I imagine it must feel like that for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that's where it comes back to one of your earlier questions, that you have to manage that team spirit without actually forgetting or opting out of sometimes difficult people decisions when someone's not working out to let them go. Because culture is as much who you hire. I think it's maybe even bigger who you fire. Because for every person that you fire, if you actually explain why, and if it's a rare occurrence and not something that happens every other day, then people take a lot of lessons from it, and it actually percolates further than who you hire.
Yes.
So I think mixing up that sort of stern bits and what we're not going to compromise on versus where there is a genuine team spirit, I think is really key.
I can definitely relate to a lot of what you're saying there, AC. And I think I was, you know, just having a look through your website earlier on today, and you had a really nice review rating on Glassdoor, particularly quite high. And I think I got a real sense of, you know, your leadership style, the culture that you fostered at Project Imagine, the way you grow your team, the values and the culture of the company in terms of, you know, not firing people on performance, and it's all about morals and value driven rather than focusing just solely on performance. And I don't know about you, but I think we've got a real good glimpse into what it
could be. And you would have seen the negative reviews as well, right? And those are the bits that I mean, where it's like, you just can't care about it. You're not a leader to be liked. You're a leader to make the right decisions. You'd need a really thick skin. Maybe that should be one of your 3 points, but like, if you don't have thick skin, don't become a leader, because you won't be able to.
And in closing, and thank you so much. It's been really fascinating chatting to you and hearing about your approach. And the one that stuck with me is that you have visibility of salaries. I've never come across a business before that does that, which really sends a strong message out about your transparency. That really is very strong. So what about the future? AC? What are the things that you're excited about for the future?
How far in the future are we going? Is this blue sky or next few months? I think next few months is going to be interesting. You know, no matter what turns out of it, I think it's going to be very rewarding as leaders, for not just for me, but for leaders all across the world, because this is a time to lead and be there for everyone and still sort of keep our eye on the target and not stop working hard. And I think empathy is going to count for a lot in leadership more than ever before in these next few months. Hopefully we all come out of it with some structural shifts in the way the world sort of consumes, and you know, environmental damage and pollution, and almost across the bits. It would be really silly to come out of this crisis with kind of wasting it, you know, kind of Churchillian way. And beyond that, what I would be really, really interested on to sort of take that PIMS idea into more commercial bits, and like if we can do something in the education space with sort of these new ways of thinking about people and skills needed in the new modern economy, I think Project Imagine's vision would align with that, but that's probably very far out, because before anything, we've got a commercial enterprise to stabilize.
Yes. Okay. And any kind of last note, anything you just like to put out there as a last comment, perhaps, to help aspiring managers and leaders to be better performers? Any kind of last phrase you'd like to just end with?
I guess if you've managed to get to this point of the podcast and not switched off, then you're probably someone we want to speak to. You know, you care about these topics, and you know, tell us what do you like. If you like what we're doing, just drop us a line. We're all pretty approachable. And we actually don't do CVs for hiring. I forgot to mention that before. So we always want to know why you want to join us, what's your ideal role, and why now. And if you can answer those three questions, then we're always looking for good talent. So drop us a line.
How would they get in touch with you, AC, if somebody liked your style and think, oh yeah, that would be interesting to find out more or explore that a bit further or talk to you about your future of your business or roles? How would they get in? What's the best way to get in touch?
You know what? I'm going to resist from answering that, because it's actually really easy to get in touch with us.
Okay.
And use the way you get in touch as one of the data points in the application. So I'm not going to give you the secret code.
Okay.
But if you look around, there's plenty of email addresses and stuff that you can use to.
Fantastic. Thank you very, very much indeed. I've loved it. Great interview.
Yeah, I really appreciate your time as well, AC. Thank you very much. It's really interesting here, as I said at the start, about your difference in your corporate role to where you are now with Project Imagine, and the whole culture you have with fostering your team and the values and everything. I find that really fascinating. So, yeah, just again, a big thank you from me as well.
Absolute pleasure, guys. Thanks very much.
Thank you.